Welcome to the Catholic Leaders Podcast, where we talk with inspirational leaders and explore how faith informs leadership. I'm Carrie Robinson, a member of the board of Leadership Roundtable.
And I'm Kim Smolik, an executive partner at Leadership Roundtable. Leadership Roundtable is a ministry of hope for the church, founded to promote best practices in leadership and management.
We're so excited to have you join us today. So click the subscribe button and let's get started.
Kim, it is so good to see you. Welcome, welcome back from your extraordinary experience on the Camino.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm so glad to be back and so glad that one of the things I get to do right on the heels of coming back is spend some time with you.
It is just so wonderful to be back together again as co-hosts, reunited, teeing off this terrific podcast. We have both experienced really life-changing transitions recently. I'm so eager to hear about the Camino, and I know our listeners are going to want to hear the pearls of wisdom from you since you are freshly back from that experience. And of course, I am now just beginning my third month as the president and CEO of Catholic Charities USA. It has been a remarkable blessing to serve alongside so many people in service to those who are suffering in our country. So, Kim, tell us just even one story, one rich, beautiful story from your experience.
What a gift to be asked, honestly. I am very much still in this, we might call, liminal space. I know I'm back. I don't feel like my feet are totally on the ground yet, but I'm trying to get here. And one of the things that's doing that is having the opportunity to share a little bit about the journey. I was thinking about a story I might share in relation to what we discussed with Ellen and just all the pearls of wisdom that she shared with us and her heart for young adults in the church and the quality of how we engage with young adults and each other that makes the experience of church a draw for people, a reason they want to be there. And that was really apparent to me on the Camino. When you're walking the Camino de Santiago, for me, I was there for, walking for nearly 6 weeks. I had the opportunity to encounter so many different people from different walks of life, different countries. And sometimes I would walk with someone for 2 hours, sometimes for 2 days. In one case, I made a very close friend that I walked with for 4 weeks. And one of the first things on the Camino, you ask someone their name, you ask them where they're from, and then very quickly you ask them why they're there. And that opens up the space to talk about their life and what is most important to them. And there's such a readiness on the Camino because we're walking each day and in such a communion with nature, communion with God, that the answers come from the heart. And it's really a blessing to be able to hear those stories from each other. But what I really noted was that you don't talk about what you do for a living, really, or what your title is, or you don't know how much, you don't know about power and influence and money and some of those things in our life that we just pay attention to, whether it's conscious or subconscious. And what you do notice, what I've reflected on, is I stayed walking with people, and I think others, with each other, based on the quality of their presence, the openness of their heart, their ability to listen, their interest in and curiosity about themselves and about God and about each other, about me. And that was such a gift to be able to engage with people in a way I think we're meant to engage with each other in the church. And I think that we heard from Ellen the authenticity that young adults are seeking. To me, that experience was so authentic. And I think it points to the kind of engagement young adults, non-young adults are really looking for. That's not really a nugget. That was more like a boulder of a story. That's one of the many sort of things I'm taking away and integrating at this time.
It's beautiful, though, and it's directly relevant to our conversation with Ellen. One of the things that I wrote down when she said it, because I was so impressed, we were talking to her about young adults leaving the church or being non-religious and kind of distancing themselves from the tradition that they had been raised in, or just finding themselves sort of unaffiliated. And she said this: "I don't think it's a problem to be solved. It's an invitation to figure out ministry for a generation that is not necessarily responding to the ministerial styles that have been in vogue for the last 20 years. And that's good." I was so impressed when she said that. I think our listeners are going to love this episode so much. And you could not have teed it up better with introducing our listeners to a little boulder of your experience from the Camino.
Yeah, that's very generous. Thank you. I think you pointed to something really relevant that Ellen brought up that's related to the synod, the synodal process that we're in right now. 360 people are still gathered in Rome at this time, the bishops, Pope Francis, and lay people gathered in Rome at this time for the historical event for the first time ever, including laity in the process of a synod. And I actually just had the opportunity yesterday to speak with one of the facilitators at the synod, so on the ground, and heard a little bit about the experience there. And what he shared with me was that something kind of similar to what I just shared, which is that one of his observations, he said he's leading a table that's sort of on the edge or the periphery of the room. So he has a view of the whole room from where he sits. And he noticed that when people get up and share from a story from their heart, the whole room gets quite quiet and leans in. And when people share only from sort of their head and from a theological reflection that doesn't connect as much with the heart, there's a qualitative difference in the room. And of course, recognizing we need both of those things, but that we're really making space for the stories of our lived experience of our faith in this synodal process. Again, I want to point to this conversation we had with Ellen, what young adults are wanting in terms of their engagement with the church. I think it's happening on the floor of the synod right now, and I'm so excited about it.
Beautiful. Well, let's let our listeners hear from Ellen, because this is just going to be terrific and perfectly timed. Welcome back, Kim.
Thanks, Carrie.
Welcome back to the Catholic Leaders Podcast. We are delighted to have with us today Ellen Konek. Ellen is Executive Director of Commonweal Magazine, a Catholic lay-led publication committed to hosting thought-provoking discussions surrounding faith, public affairs, and the arts through their magazine, website, podcast, and live and virtual events. Prior to joining Commonweal, she was the head writer at Springtide Research Institute, which studies and listens to the experiences of young people. She also shared her expertise as an adjunct professor at Sacred Heart University. Ellen studied theology at St. Mary's University of Minnesota and received a Master of Arts in Religion from Yale Divinity School, which is where I had the privilege of first meeting her. Ellen, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for all that you and your colleagues at Commonweal do to promote conversation and the common good.
Thank you so much for having me. I am delighted to be here.
Ellen, welcome. We love to start our podcast by giving our listeners a glimpse into the paths our guests have taken and where they are today. While many of our listeners may be familiar with Commonweal and read its amazing content, they might just be meeting you for the first time, the woman leading the magazine for the first time in its history. So would you take us on your leadership journey? So how did you come to work in Catholic media? Maybe a little bit about your role as executive director of Commonweal, and how has your personal faith life informed your leadership?
Sure. These are excellent questions. I'll say practically speaking, I landed at Commonweal because there was a job opening about 10 years ago. And my husband was planning to attend Columbia Law School, and I was looking for an equally good gig on the East Coast that would sort of justify our move from the Midwest. And there was a job opening for an editorial assistant at Commonweal. And I thought, well, goodness, this is the kind of job I'd hope to have after, you know, a master's degree. Like, I'm nowhere near qualified to be at this institution, but what if they let me in? So about 10 years ago, indeed, they let me in. We moved to New York and lived in Morningside Heights. And that's sort of practically how it came to be. I was an editorial assistant first and, you know, went through the mail and answered the phones and archived the magazine, like the hard copies of the magazine. And my draw, my kind of attraction to Catholic media in general is really a version of my attraction to theology and religious studies and philosophy. These were subjects I was always really caught up with, and I knew I wanted to study and devote myself to these kinds of questions. And I saw Commonweal doing exactly the kind of work I thought needed to be done in the world, which was to take the questions and concerns of theology, the questions that humans have been asking themselves for thousands of years, the things that keep us up at night, and bringing those questions outside the ivory tower and outside of expertise, and rendering them, you know, dressing them in the style of questions that are completely contextualized for our modern world. I think that's the most important thing about theology, is having it matter, making it, you know, making sure it has stakes in the world for real people, and that it's not too abstracted. Now, that's nothing against, you know, highly abstracted and academic theology. I kind of love that stuff, but I knew I wanted to be in a world where we could take the questions and concerns of, you know, these existential, spiritual, and religious questions, and make them accessible, create a space where people can come together to ask and answer them.
I'd love to dig in a little bit into your journey into taking on this role as executive director. We, in our positions here at Leadership Roundtable, have the extraordinary privilege of working with incredible women in the church, leading in various ways. And I'm curious about what your experience has been taking on this role at Commonweal as the first female leader. What you're able to bring to the role in particular, if you've been able to notice some things there, and what adjustments even you or others have had to make in this transition?
That's a great question. And right now my role as executive director is, it's a new role for the magazine, actually. And I took over for Tom Baker, who was Commonweal's publisher. We sort of updated both the role and the tasks of the role when Tom retired, in part because we realized that there are different things happening there, and a media organization like Commonweal has to be paying attention to different kinds of things. It's not like a publisher in, you know, the 70s and 80s made a lot of sense for a magazine that had, you know, a strong and dedicated readership, but wasn't trying to do much more than serve that readership. And now we think of Commonweal as so much broader, hosting conversations in a wide variety of forums. the print magazine being kind of at the heart of it, but in all of these other iterations as well. And so, to be honest, it's hard to parse the difference in my role, like as a woman in the magazine, on the one hand, because I've been part of the magazine for a decade as a board member and, you know, as an editorial assistant early on and working with Tom Baker on special projects after I finished my master's degree. So I've been in and out of the life of the magazine in ways that probably blur the newness of my role in terms of leadership a little bit for me, because I'm stepping into something quite familiar. And also, you know, it's hard to parse because it's a slightly different role. Someone hasn't played it before. So in that way, I have the privilege of being both the first, you know, sort of executive director woman, but also the first executive director. So I'm forging a path that's not been blazed before, I'm sure.
Ellen, for as long as I've known you, you've manifested a great care for young adults, and you believe strongly in the importance of supporting their faith and leadership. I think this is clear in both your scholarship and writing. Ensuring young adults are able to cultivate an adult mature life of faith and exercise their faith in leadership matters to so many of our Leadership Roundtable constituents. In fact, we are making it the central focus of our upcoming 2024 Catholic Partnership Summit to focus specifically on ways to engage young adults in the life and leadership of the church. We know from recent studies that there is a growing skepticism and disillusionment among young adults toward religious institutions. You spent many years with Springtide studying young adults and the church, and we'd love your expert take on this rather complex issue. How do we as a church foster a meaningful connection with young adults and involve them in the life of the church itself?
I love this question, and I wish there was one answer for it. And one really easy, if only you tick this box, the problem is solved. Actually, you know what? I take that back. I don't think it's a problem to be solved. It's just an invitation to figure out ministry for a generation that is not necessarily responding to the ministerial styles that have been in vogue for the last 20 years. And that's good. What we weren't doing in the 90s, what we did in the 1890s. So like, this is a very natural thing. And there's an invitation at the heart of it. When I think about the question about, you know, what at its core can we do to help young adults and young people feel that they are invited into the life of the church, I think of a story from when I was maybe 14 or 15, and I sort of had my arms crossed and was like tapping my foot, waiting for the church to, you know, make sense of itself for me. And I remember, you know, having learned about like the Inquisition or something like that fairly recently. And I was like, do we all know about this? Like, that's some rough stuff. Like, have we resolved that? That's a problem, you know? And, you know, I didn't know that there was plenty of commentary on this. I just found out that there was this sort of egregious moment in our history, and I couldn't make sense of it being not at all part of the Sunday morning, you know, ritual that I'd been involved in for my whole life. So I had said this to like a youth minister or a faith formator, I can't remember the context, and I just said, you know, this is a problem, and I have other problems too, and I have questions, and I don't know where to get the answers, and all of those. My posture was, you know, prove to me that it's worth staying, because I otherwise I think I'll leave. And the counselor, who at the time of course could not give me answers to all of these questions, many of which I didn't actually articulate very well at all, she just said very simply, if those are things that concern you, stick around to solve them. That's it. Just that was it. You're the generation that can take up those questions. That can be you. That can be your work. And I credit that really significantly with my sense of I don't know, empowerment might be the wrong word, but my sense of feeling that I can be in the church and this is how I would maybe extend this or universalize it for the broader question you asked, which is that the important thing I think is young adults and young people feel invited to stay amid seasons of doubt, or that they stay while recognizing the church in its brokenness, rather than trying to sell them something that's a little too shiny and in that way a little too suspect. Young people are naturally skeptical. That's a good thing. There's reason for skepticism. But to empower them with the responsibility that this church is theirs to remedy, and this church that has been an anchor for generations of saints and sinners continues to be available to them if they will put in the work of staying. And that to me is the best posture forward, is to give a very like honest, would you take up the work with us, instead of, do you want to, you know, be at the front of the room with the lights? Like, you know, the style of leadership, the style of involvement that the church needs is not this shiny kind that pretends everything is okay. It's the kind that's gritty and admits there's a lot of work to do. Will you please stay and do it with us? This can be yours.
That is so beautiful. It is not a problem to be solved. It is an invitation. It changes the entire relationship to young adults and moves us from critic to exercising agency for an inspiring future alongside with and on behalf of young adults.
I'm so grateful for you sharing that story. I mean, as a writer, you know the power of the personal story, right? And I'm so grateful for the places where we can tell these stories of how people have engaged themselves in the church, and the church has said yes to that engagement. And even if it's a little bit painful, I remember from my childhood when I was at a Catholic school, we had, you know, of course we went to Mass regularly, and there were only at that time boy altar servers. And I took issue with it. And I started raising the issue at the school and at the parish. It was my parish as well. And within a year's time, they listened. They listened to us, and it was within, you know, the allowance of the church. And so girls started to be able to serve as altar servers. And I remember my teacher came up to me and to tell me when the preparation for it was going to begin. And I said, oh, I'm not interested in being an altar server. I just wanted girls to have the opportunity to do it, to see some of myself up, you know, I had other ways that I wanted to serve. But just that chance to engage in the conversation and to look at where the possibilities are for young people or for any of us who are looking for ways to engage in the church in new ways, that the conversation is at least open, right? We're curious a little bit to hear a little bit more from you about what actions the church or its many institutions could commit to in order to engage the values and perspectives of young people at this time to ensure that they can be engaged in these meaningful conversations so that they don't feel stopped if they feel as though something they think or wonder about might not be accepted.
Yeah, I think the church has the first responsibility, and this is, you know, I'm previewing my thoughts on synodality, but the very first action is listening. And it must be. And, you know, I don't necessarily think it's the church's responsibility to reflect just what they hear young people saying they care about. You know, the church is in the formation game, and young people are poised to be formed. They're still sometimes quite malleable, you know, depending on the age. You know, I consider myself still malleable in a lot of ways. So it's the church is a forming institute, but to be able to do effective ministry and to encourage people to stay, there has to be listening at the heart of the church. And the reason for this is that people who don't feel that they are heard or reflected will slip out the back. They don't see themselves represented in leadership, and they also don't feel that it's safe to ask the question. They'll slip out the back. And it's a lucky and sometimes all too rare occasion that somebody has the chance to speak up before they slip out the back. But I think the beginning of building trust with young adults and young people and this upcoming generation is listening. And so rather than trying to imagine what do young people care about and then how do we better reinforce that or talk about that, knowing what young people care about, whether or not it's what the church cares about, you know, formally, creedally, et cetera, I think is really important, because the church doesn't need to, for example, care about social media. I mean, it should care about it insofar as it matters, and it matters to and impacts young people's lives in ways that are beyond what we probably even know how to describe at the moment. They're digital natives. Much of their worlds are happening in virtual spaces. And so it's not to be for or against, you know, the online experience as much as it is to be aware of what their experience is, so that then the message of the gospel or the message of invitation, the meaning, purpose, community can be rendered, can be translated for young people, so that the church's values remain the church's values, but they're presented in a way that can actually get through to young people, because it has some of their vernacular or some of their stakes are kept in mind for it. That strikes me as one of the most important things the church do, is just learn to listen. And you know, as one of the things that actually I love, Pope Francis says in Christus Vivit, the church needs your momentum, your intuitions, your faith. We need them, with an exclamation point. And when you arrive where we have not yet reached, have the patience to wait for us. That is like the model that I think of when I think of how to engage young people. Just trust what they're doing, watch what they're doing, and then figure out how to translate that into what the church is also doing. They don't have to be the same thing, but they can be in conversation.
I want to sort of transition in a little bit here into asking about a little bit more about the synod and synodality in terms of what it's doing, particularly for bringing young people toward the church, or maybe those of us who have been around longer toward young people.
I think the only thing I would say is the beauty of this synodal process is that the church already has so much to offer, and you know, we think of the things that it turns out the church values are the things that young people also value: care for creation, participation in society, a voice for the voiceless, the dignity of work. These are all things the church has maintained for so long as values, and that young people also can say that, you know, they rank on surveys, that these are highly, highly important things. But to actually come together at the same table for listening, rather than having a kind of one-sided dialogue, you know, there's so much room for miscommunication. So this strikes me as such a beautiful gift, because it's this opportunity for the shepherd to smell like the sheep, and for the sheep to actually feel, you know, the things we have said we care about have been heard. Like, this is a beautiful moment, I think, in the church.
Well, speaking of beautiful moments, Commonweal is approaching its 100th anniversary. Wow, congratulations. As Commonweal approaches its 100th anniversary, can you share your thoughts on the significance of this milestone? How does Commonweal plan to celebrate its rich history while also looking forward to the future of Catholic intellectual life and the role Commonweal will continue to play in fostering critical conversations on faith, politics, and culture?
We are so excited. Thank you for the congratulations. We are so excited to be turning 100. And I, in particular, in fact, I sometimes get like a little weepy, which I will try not to do, when I think of the number of people who have gotten us to this point, and then to be, you know, on the staff at the cusp is just like incredible. Like, to imagine all the donors, the readers, the editors, the publishers, like the writers who contributed, and like for 100 years of continuous publication, and this project, it sort of, in some ways, I think has foreshadowed, or, you know, it's been synodal before the synod was cool is sometimes what we say. It's been this exercise in reflecting the concerns of the U.S. Catholics, especially at a time when, in 1924, when the magazine was launched, American Catholics were attempting to forge an identity. What does it mean to be an American and a Catholic? And those questions continue to be relevant, but they have iterated in every decade and applied differently in every decade. And I find it so exciting for the reasons I talked about before, this work of sort of doing theology, but out in the world where it has stakes. And theology, I mean, broadly to include, you know, the pursuit of justice and the, you know, contemplation of beauty in the arts and, you know, all of our issues have poetry and photos and, you know, and essays in them. It has been this critical forum for a long time to help people work out what it means to have certain kinds of stakes in the world, and not just for Catholics, for people who are religious in general. And I think our work in the world is poised to be even bigger into our second century. I think right now we have this kind of moment of critical reflection in society where we have been faced with sort of insults to truth and to justice in ways that are very, very public in recent years. And we have sort of seen lots of whataboutism or both sidesism and things that sort of fail to take a side or fail to have stakes in ways that really matter. And Commonwealth doesn't shy away from the difficulties of nuance and from the long form. And we're like practically allergic to a hot take, which I think are diminishing our capacity for public discourse. And public discourse is this needed thing, especially as, you know, polarization continues in society. So I think of this sort of widespread religious illiteracy that's part of, you know, media and culture nowadays. And I think of the intense polarization where two sides of various camps don't want to talk to each other at all, let alone find common ground. And then I see instances where common ground is found, but it's by watering down anything relevant to either side. And Commonweal doesn't do any of those things. Like it is really attempting to do this wrestling so that people can come away with more than they arrived. Somebody recently said that they come to Commonweal not for answers, but to figure out what question to ask. And I love that. I love it so much. And it's part of the reason I think we have a future that will be brighter even than its past, because we have this posture of figuring out the right question to ask and then taking all the time in the world to ask it. And with all the nuance needed and all the charity and rigor that dialogue needs today. In terms of our celebrations, well, we have a lot planned. We're launching some really exciting initiatives and projects for our second century. And we will, of course, be having a big party. We have a gala. Carrie was our Catholic in the Public Square Award winner at our most recent gala. And we will have a 2024 100th birthday party where we will be pulling out all the stops. But those details are in the works. You know, invitations have not yet been sent, but save the dates soon for October. Yeah, you're both invited. October 2024, there'll be a big party and a lot more announced in the interim too.
And hopefully that is an opportunity for all of your subscribers and people who have benefited over this century to contribute to the next 100 years of Commonweal's flourishing life.
Yes. We would be thrilled and honored to have so many more people participate in the reach and the relevance of our magazine in myriad ways. And that is certainly one of them.
Well, I love how you talk about, from the beginning of this podcast, how you've been talking about how committed and engaged you are to questions of theology in places that matter. And you're doing that in a variety of ways at Commonweal, including these Commonweal communities, we're promoting the Commonweal communities, which are, as I understand, discussion groups of your readers interested in diving deeper into the topics that you bring up. And Commonweal conversations, which are in-person gatherings, which are increasingly rare. And I wish that I was in a place where those were taking place. So this just really, it can, continues your tradition of lifting up and really valuing lay voices and the engagement in rigor, as you said, and both rigor and charity around these topics. So can you elaborate on the work of Commonweal today to amplify lay voices and your perspectives on what you see emerging from this commitment?
Yeah, the laity, this is the heart of our work. We are Catholic, but we're not, we don't have any institutional oversight from the Catholic Church. So we're sort of Catholic with a lowercase c in some ways, truly Catholic, you know, Roman Catholic tradition. And I think in the very first editorial in 1924, the editor at the time called it Holy Mother Church. So, you know, like it's the real deal, Catholicism. But this has been a project of the laity. And this was before, this was, you know, 40 years before the Second Vatican Council sort of invited this level of participation and leadership in a public way. So it was, this has been our project since the beginning. And I think it continues to be a really relevant one, even while we have great friends and writers who are, you know, clergy or brothers or sisters, religious, it is a project that belongs to the laity. And Carrie, I wrote this down one time, you said this, which I hope is okay. I wrote it down because it was so meaningful to me. But our very own Carrie Robinson said, it's the legacy of the laity in some ways. And if we weren't yet doing it, we would want it done. And that is such a testament to me about the space we take up and the niche that we occupy, that we would very centrally focus both our leadership and our content on the voices of people who, you know, are not standing up at the pulpit on Sunday mornings, that there's a space carved out for this other kind of voice to be regularly platformed.
On that note, how do you perceive the importance of Catholic intellectual life beyond traditional institutions of learning in today's world? What does this look like, and what impact is it having on our church, particularly when we think of lay intellectuals?
Yeah. I want to answer that just by saying it's so important. Like, how do I perceive the importance? It's so important. And I think I love the part of this question that asks about the non-institutional spaces, because increasingly we see that young people, for example, hesitate around institutions. And part of my work at Springtide, we were looking into this lack of trust around institutions. And it makes some good sense. First of all, institutions have done a lot to lose trust, to actively lose trust, you know, big banks and conspiracy theories and the sex abuse scandal. Like, there is plenty of reason to tiptoe up to institutions rather than take everything without a grain of salt. And I think this can be a gift to the church, this skepticism, this requirement to earn trust rather than have it as a, you know, as a given, a presumption. So I think places like Commonweal and Leadership Roundtable, for that matter, and plenty of other ministries and activities in the sort of religion world that are they're sort of parachurch groups. They're sort of adjacent to the institution. They've been carving out space all along for us to have very free conversations. And this will be a service to the next generation who is already skeptical about walking through the doors of the institutional church, to have these spaces already built up that are ready for conversation that might be difficult or would be met with suspicion if in the, you know, the doors of the church. So I think there's this critical role that places like Commonweal, but lots of other places as well, play and will continue to play by hosting these sort of adjacent religious conversations in places that are safe and free to really explore and have difficult conversations where that might not be the experience institutionally otherwise.
How, Ellen, how can the Catholic intellectual tradition specifically help Catholic institutions address polarization in the church today?
Well, I think polarization is, it's a big problem, of course. And also, it is no wonder that the church is experiencing it because we are capacious enough for differing opinions. We are a church that, this is truly my favorite thing about the church. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I love the sacraments. I love the saints. But also another thing that I love is that we have a model where, you know, Peter and Paul butted heads and they both stuck around. You know, these were our kind of preeminent leaders in the church. So butting heads is part of the deal as far as I'm concerned. And I think that's actually a sign, a good sign in the church, that there is not uniformity means people have not been left out. Polarization, I said in a recent lecture, is a sign that people have dug their heels in and they're sticking around and that they cannot be dissuaded from the church by virtue of disagreement with the guy down the pew. And I really believe that. I think it's a sign of a healthy church. And I think it's also what makes us different than a lot of other denominations in the US. We can't fire someone, we can't fire the priest who gave a homily we didn't like. You know, we can't pick up and move down the block or start our own. We kind of just have to grit our teeth and say, this goes back to the story I told earlier. I'm going to stick around. This is mine too. I want to be a part of this. And for us to have the privilege of debating the best way for the church to live up to its vocation is, it means that there are enough of us who care passionately that the church does live up to its vocation in the world. So your question was actually, how does the Catholic intellectual life bear on this? And I think there's a long precedent for disagreement in the church. And then we have things like councils and saints and doctors of the church and leaders who can weigh in, often in retrospect, to resolve something. But in the meantime, like, we're in the messy middle, and that's a fine place to be. It has been this way. I can't imagine a time in the church that it has not been this way. We just are more attuned to it because we have not just our parish experience, you know, but we have like a sense of the whole too. So we're more attuned to it, but I don't think it's very different than what has been true before.
This is incredible. Your insights here. There are so many places I would like to follow up. One of the things that you mentioned was the importance of creating spaces and places of belonging in the church. And we might say, especially for young people, who are feeling this impact of isolation, of polarization, of the impact of social media that we yet, as you said, to fully understand. And I'm wondering what insights you have for what the church and its many institutions can do to contribute to ministering to these young people, because you write so beautifully about grief and about themes related to the many emotions surrounding grief. And I wonder how your expertise in this area might shed a little light here for us.
Well, first of all, I wish I weren't an expert. I appreciate this question very much because I think the church, I was just saying, you know, we're all in this to help the church become itself, to live its vocation. And when we bump into an area where the church is not quite doing the work that maybe it could or should, we're the church, you know, so that's an indictment on our own capacities. And so my brother died by suicide several years ago, 6 or 7 years ago. I'd have to know what year it is right now for me to know how long ago it was. And that's not possible. It's all a blur. And I, you know, there was a lot of, there were many, many people who were kind to me in that those early days of grief. And there were many things offered me that were totally ill-fitting, that like did not work. They did not make sense of a good God. You know, they didn't, I remember feeling like I just wanted to be held. I wanted to be cared for. I remember thinking that too, like as a new mother, like I just want to be cared for right now. And I don't want it to feel hard to get care. But unfortunately, like it was, and that's okay. And I think if I didn't have this deep commitment to the church, it would have been an easy time for me to say, this is not working and this is my hour of need. And this should be the time that ministry comes most, you know, most swiftly. So I think that the lady have this role when we experience a lack in the church's resources or availability to us to step up and try to fill some of those. And I have a good friend who just finished writing a book on postpartum depression, because she said, I didn't know where to turn or who to turn to. And here I am, you know, well-versed in theology, but without a sense of how to apply it to this new scenario that I'm in. So I think there are these ways in which we can step into those voids when we experience them. And one I would put on the top of the list is the mental health crisis among young people, the rampant experience of isolation and alienation, that I don't think the church has a response to that. And it is belonging and it is the body of Christ, but how to say that in an invitation, in a way that responds to the wounds that are already intact, in ways that the church may have even caused some of those wounds by failing to help somebody belong or feel, you know, understood and safe in the first place. There are layers to the work of mental health advocacy and ministry, but it's work that has to be undertaken and kind of urgently, I think. But I think this is work that we can't wait for the sort of institutional or hierarchical church to take up. It will no doubt start with the laity who are bumping into it for themselves and then figuring out, we need something here. So I think I'll start building it.
Can you point to any places where you're seeing some of this happen, even in its beginning stages in the church or in Catholic institutions?
I think another area that, you know, it's not necessary. Well, it is tied hand in hand with mental health, of course. But I think Father Jim Martin was a guest of yours on this podcast, and the work that he's doing with outreach is, I think, really powerful. It's one of these. It's tied up with mental health. Because young people we know who identify as LGBTQ+ are more likely to have suicidal ideation. They're more likely to be bullied or to experience violence, and to also feel shunned by the church of the gospel adds such a distinct layer to those wounds. So I think that is such a good example of a very concrete need and a ministry built out to say, we want to be responsive to this. We want to build out resources and theologies that can make more space rather than have that conversation completely closed before it even begins.
Ellen, thank you for bringing your beautiful writing, but also your vulnerability to writing about grief and about suicide and about mental health. I wish you were not an expert too. However, so many people have benefited from your willingness to amplify your own experience and share that with others. It's a great grace for many of us. You mentioned earlier in our conversation some of the things you most love about our faith. One of the things I most love is the conviction of eternal life and the fact that love doesn't end in death. We always end our conversations with asking one question to each of our guests. What is one action that if we all did it tomorrow, it would help build a stronger, more vibrant church?
You know, I even knew you were going to ask this because I have heard it on the podcast. And it's still so hard to answer. I think I would just say, and maybe this is too light a touch, but I would say listening. I think that the needed action to make everything else unfold is to listen. And that means, you know, there's a lot that has to happen for listening to work, including that you have to be in the same room as somebody who has something to say and trusts you enough to say it. But I really think that is the beginning of deeper relationships and for the church to be what it needs to be for the next generation, to reach them and to be a space of meaning and belonging. It has to know who it's talking to. And right now that's happening here and there, but it can happen even more. And I think that would build a stronger and more vibrant church.
Profound in its simplicity, to be sure. And it has been a great gift to get to listen to you today and to hear a little bit about your journey and your insights to our church and to the journey we are on together. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I cannot wait to see you in Minnesota when I'm visiting this summer and at your big celebration in October of 2024.
I can't thank you both enough for this warm and wonderful conversation and such a gift to be with the two of you for this span of time.
It is always a joy to host the Catholic Leaders Podcast. A special thank you to our terrific colleagues who make this podcast possible, to our eloquent and inspiring guests, and to you, our deeply appreciated listeners.
We're especially grateful for the production support of Jenna McAndrew, Leslie Rodriguez, and Kate Alexander. Original theme music by Rachel Taylor. And as always, the generous sponsors of Leadership Roundtable. Before you go, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We'll see you next time.